Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Darth Vader. I'll be honest, the mask doesn't make me breathe like that. I just think it sounds cool. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men.
I'm Alex. With me is James.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, Jim. Sorry, James. Professional.
Yeah, man. Come on. Being a professional, we're having a little laugh before the podcast.
Yeah, we often have laughs. Laughs.
But now it's time to get down to business.
Yeah, all business. There's no joking around here at the MacGuffin Man.
Got my podcast gear on. The socks and a hoodie.
And shorts.
Yep.
Yeah, we're real professional. Let's get to it.
And once again, you cut the lovely banter short. Yeah. Anyway, when I was younger, I think like most people in our generation, spent a lot of time watching television.
Yes.
Animated shows too, cartoons and stuff. I was big on Animaniacs. Mm-hmm. Were you a fan?
I didn't love it. It certainly wasn't my favorite, but I enjoyed it. I certainly watched it.
Yeah, it was one that I watched a lot, and Steven Spielberg produced it or executive produced or something. And I didn't really realize it at the time, but so much of it was pop culture stuff and a lot of, you know, references to film and stuff. And when you're a kid, you don't get it. They're just kind of characters who have certain voices and cadences, but you don't really grasp the concept that they're alluding to something else.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe kind of like what Pixar is doing now, they kind of throw these jokes in for the adults so it's not as painful for them to sit through the shows and the movies.
Yeah, yeah. I think Pixar is less referential and more just sort of generally good. You know, like I think a lot of what made Animaniacs specifically interesting was that it was referencing things that we didn't totally get, like the Pinky and the Brain doing the Orson Welles thing.
Yeah.
You know, and like, there's no way we could have gotten that when we were eight. That was just sort of, you know, writers having fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if their parents happen to catch it, then so be it. Whereas Pixar is just sort of, they're just making legitimately good movies.
That also appeal to kids.
Exactly.
And adults.
Okay. They're good enough that, you know, and they're G-rated, you know, so the kids can see it. But if, I don't know, if you take the kid appeal away from WALL-E, it's still a spectacular movie.
Yeah, true. So I guess this is more about Animaniacs. Just that they have that, sort of, as you said, the writers are kind of having fun with it, but there's also sort of a shorthand in culture where, you know, there is this thing in literature too where there's allusions that go back all the way to, like, Greek mythology and stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But in, you know, kind of modern pop culture, we get away from a lot of that classical stuff and we're just referencing movies from the 50s or the 60s and things like that. And one of kind of the staple personas would be that of Woody Allen.
Yep.
And that's kind of one of those reoccurring characters. And again, when you're a kid, you don't get that it's a reference to a real person or a series of characters in movies. But it's absolutely one of those just staples of pop culture referencing.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like kids watching Ants in 1998 or whenever that movie came out and clearly did not understand how much funnier that movie is if you've seen some Woody Allen movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's Woody Allen being the character that he always is.
Who just happens to be an insect this time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a good movie, you know. But anyway.
Yeah, no, but it's just, I think the way a lot of stuff is kind of, instead of doing those older allusions to, you know, mythology and older literature, they're keeping it really recent with somewhat contemporary stuff. And Woody Allen, I think, is a big part of that. And I think it just speaks to how much one person, you know, really was a staple of the pulp culture scene altogether, right? Mm-hmm. And Annie Hall, which is the movie we're talking about today, wasn't by far his first thing. You know, people knew who he was before him, before Annie Hall, but this is what really made him arrive in sort of more so in an artistic way.
Yeah, and he sort of said that himself, that Annie Hall sort of marks the beginning of a shift away, well, not away from comedy, obviously. He's still making comedies now, but to, you know, trying to be a little bit more serious in the movies he's making. And, I mean, Annie Hall is, I would define it as a comedy, but if you took all the jokes out, I would still like this movie.
Yeah, and you're right. He did have a career before that, and he was making movies for about 10 years before Annie Hall came out. But as you said, this is the last time, in his words, he was just going for all the laughs possible. Mm-hmm. You know, if you take all the jokes out of this one, you could really make a good just kind of drama about a relationship. At the same time, if you took out a lot of the really heavy relationship stuff, you can still see a good comedy here.
Oh, yeah, this movie's hilarious.
Yeah, and it's just, you're right.
And it is aged better than most comedies from the 70s. Like, it's still hysterical.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that a little bit more. Yeah. near the end. But so this was 1977 that Annie Hall came out. And so Woody Allen had a career. He was a stand-up comedian. He was a writer. And then he kind of got into filmmaking and was doing a lot of comedies and stuff, as we said, kind of just going for every laugh possible. But this one was a transition for him, and he still continued to make some comedies after that, but this kind of gave him the transition from just a comedian to more of an artist, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we should just do as we normally do, just go through a little a brief synopsis of the movie and then kind of get into more what it means.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the movie sort of starts off with Woody Allen basically, or I guess Woody Allen playing Elvis Singer, basically doing a stand-up comedy bit to like a short bit of comedy to the camera, like yeah. breaking the fourth wall
right off the bat, breaking yeah. the fourth wall.
And it's sort of, you know, we'd sort of explain his background, how his family you know, raised him, where he was raised, and continuing to be very postmodern throughout this. He sort of imagines himself in his classroom and stuff like that. And from there we sort of after we get the background of Alvy, we sort of start jumping around through Alvy's life, specifically with a focus on his relationship with Annie Hall. The thing about this movie that makes it difficult to synopsize is that I never remember the order of the things that happen.
No.
And that's the point, is that it's about a relationship, but it's not told linearly at all. There's never a clear passage of time.
No.
You never know how much time has passed. And that's totally important in the movie. I could tell you a number of scenes that happened, but I could not tell you with any certainty what order they happen in.
Yeah, and I was just, you know, in doing research for this, I saw someone who tried to put forward their best guess of the chronology of it. And there are some hints, and obviously some things happen after some things.
Yeah, but there's people he dates after Annie and before Annie.
Yeah, but they're...
And during somehow.
Yeah, and as you said, it's very hard to tell what it is, and I certainly don't remember the order of the movie either, and I've seen that movie a bunch, and... Yeah. I watched it all the way through and then realized I still don't know the synopsis, like in the order that it appears. And I think it isn't. Why do you think that's important to the movie? Do you think that's just it ended up being that, you know, doing these things in the order that they do show them is the best way to tell the story? Do you think there's something about this sort of disjointed way of storytelling that gets to kind of some of the themes of the movie?
Well, I think the reason the movie is so good to me is that it's sort of, and I mean, we find this out at the end, it's a person looking back at their relationship. And when you look back at a relationship you've had, you don't remember everything chronologically. You remember all the things that you thought were important about this person, things you did together, things, arguments you had, or, you know, spiders you killed for them at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
You remember all of these things, but you don't necessarily remember when they happened, like, you know, in the chronology. So few people are looking back on a thing that, you know, this relationship seemed to go for a while.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's safe to say that Annie Hall and Alvy Singer were together for a year, you know?
Yeah, at least.
And
yeah.
I mean, anytime you're, you know, above the age of adolescence, the timeline sort of starts to blur because you've had so much time being alive that you sort of start to lose track of when everything in your life happened.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's so disjointed, and it's sort of more of an accurate representation of these things. And, you know, the scenes sort of lead into each other. Like, he's thinking about this one thing, which logically leads to him thinking about this next thing. And I think the way the story is told is very much supposed to be inside the mind of this person who's reflecting on the relationship.
Yeah, and even if those events that he's reflecting on were, you know, years apart or a year apart or something, that's not the way your brain works all the time. And it's kind of just, you know, this feeling led to this, which reminded me of this. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, that is how you look back on things. And I think what you said about once you're out of adolescence, I think once you're out of schools and it's, you know, it's no longer, you know, grade 10 and then grade 11 or first year, then second year and things like that. That is kind of how your memory is. It's more of a kind of a blur of just things put
yeah.
together, and you can kind of piece it together. Oh, I was living here, or I was working here, or, you know, this person hadn't moved away yet and things like that.
Or in Woody Allen's case, I was working on this movie at the time and then I started to, you know, date this person.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So
and you'll always use sort of signifiers parts of your own life that were sort of significant, things that were going on. It's just that once you get out of school, you no longer have the same one as everybody else your age.
Yeah, true, so. True. I think we've already done it a few times. I do it on pretty much every podcast, but I think for this one, there's a particular reason that I'm probably going to say Woody Allen or Woody a bunch of times instead of Alvy or Alvy Singer.
Yeah.
I think with this one, it's a bit more appropriate because Woody Allen usually plays a slight variation of himself in pretty much every movie.
Yeah.
You know, he starts off talking to the camera, as you said, really like breaking the fourth wall right away, states that what you're about to see is kind of him trying to figure out where things fell apart. So we figure out that he was a comedian, which is how Woody Allen started his career as well. Then he's meeting Annie at the movie theater, and she's late for that.
Yep.
And then they have to switch movie theaters. They're waiting in line, and someone's talking really loudly behind him. Yeah. Woody Allen really hates it, and again, talks to the camera again and pulls Marshall McLuhan out to prove this guy behind him wrong.
Yeah.
It's a moment people really remember a lot from this movie, and it's pretty funny.
Well, and it's such a famous moment that a McLuhan biography is titled "The Line You Know Nothing of My Work." Douglas Copeland's book about McLuhan is called
"Really
You Know Nothing of My Work."
Oh, that's awesome. But again, with Woody Allen always playing himself in this kind of direct address to the camera in this scene and a lot of the scenes, and the way that he writes these things being semi-autobiographical, not just this movie, but a lot of the stuff he does.
We do have to point out Annie Hall is not written only by Woody Allen. Marshall Brickman co-wrote the movie, and I imagine he continually gets the shaft. But I mean,
yeah.
This is clearly Woody Allen's persona, but he was not the lone writer on this movie.
Yeah, and a lot of people say that this is kind of a history of his relationship with Annie Hall, with Diane Keaton, whose real name is Annie Hall. But it's not 100%. I mean, there's elements of it in there for sure, but it's not entirely. But I do think he writes about himself a lot and just kind of directly addressing the camera, always playing kind of a version of himself and writing about his own life. Do you think this adds kind of a personal element where people can get closer to him or feel closer to Woody Allen? Like those three factors?
Well, first, just quick point. Are you sure her name is Annie Hall and not Diane Hall?
It's Diane Hall, but they say people call her Annie.
Okay,
like her friends
cool.
and stuff call her Annie.
Yeah, I think the direct address always sort of helps you feel more a part of, you know, closer to the character because, you know, they're talking right at you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of like you're having a conversation with this person. It's just in the case of Annie Hall, you can't talk back.
Yeah.
You know, and No, it definitely helps people like the movie more and also just generally relate to the character more because it feels like a person you're talking to.
Right.
Even though you're not talking to them, they're just talking
listening.
To you.
Yeah. And so we bounce around a bit more through his history, find out that Alvy has been married twice before. We see that he kind of had sexual problems with his past wives too. One of them was a volunteer at the political campaign or something.
Yeah.
Allison, we don't learn that much about her. And then his other wife, his second ex-wife, was a kind of New York intellectual type who hung out with a lot of people from academia and, you know, very intellectual, liberal New York intellectual.
He said as he removed her brassiere.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think he does spend a lot of time criticizing New York liberal intellectuals in this. But I think that's how a lot of people see Woody Allen.
Yes, absolutely.
So is this kind of just a self-deprecating thing? I mean, he criticizes himself personally in a lot of his personal habits. Do you think this is kind of just a bigger extension of that, where not only is he criticizing himself, but he's criticizing the larger group that he's part of or seen as part of?
Well, he's certainly criticizing a group that he's seen as part of. I don't think people spend a lot of time thinking about Woody Allen non-comedy people spend a lot of time thinking about Woody Allen pre-Annie Hall.
Yeah.
But now, certainly... he has lumped into that. And I mean, there are famous stories of him not wanting to leave New York. He didn't make a movie outside of New York until post 2000. Right.
Yeah.
And, of course now he makes all of his movies overseas, but that's very often a funding thing, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know if it's necessarily a wider self-deprecating thing because he didn't know. I don't think he knew that would become his image.
Right.
I'm sure he didn't expect Annie Hall to become as well received as it was.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was happy with it when he made it.
Yeah.
But I mean, you couldn't have assumed this movie in production would become Annie Hall.
Yeah. You know? Well, I guess it's just funny now when people who, you know, younger people who watch this movie now and see him criticizing that, and that's kind of their
perception of him. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of like the poster boy of that group at that time period for a lot of people. So it's just interesting that retrospectively, it's kind of himself that he's criticizing,
yeah,
you know?
That's fair.
Then again, bouncing around, we go all the way back to Alvy and Annie meeting for the first time at the tennis match.
Yes.
And they go back to Annie's apartment and talk a little bit.
Yeah. I love this scene, by the way.
The tennis match?
The tennis match, and particularly the scene after, where they're in sort of like the lobby and Alvy's packing up and Annie offers him a ride, or, you know, that whole conversation. I think that's so funny.
What do you like about that? Just that it's funny? Or?
It's funny. I think Diane Keaton is amazing in that scene. Like, I think she's so hilariously awkward and just in such an endearing way. And Diane Keaton is not an actress I like outside of Annie Hall. And I think particularly in that scene, like, that's clearly the high point of her career to me. Like, it's not even close. Yeah. And I just think she's so endearing, and I would totally want to go have a glass of wine with her.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely.
It's not the tie and the bowler hat?
No, although I have no issues with that. You know, like, it's enjoyable. I like it. I get a kick out of somebody that'll try something new.
Yeah. And spark a brief fashion rage, as they say.
Yeah.
So then we see a bit more of them dating. She auditions. She's a bit of a singer. So we see him go with her to one of her auditions at a nightclub. They kiss for the first time, and he does something where it's in the middle of the date and says, you know, we should just kiss now to get it over with.
We'll digest our food better.
Yeah, get the awkwardness over with. And again, just kind of something Woody Allen does a lot, and I think you see a lot now, trying to just take relationships. As much as this is kind of something about how much this relationship meant to him and how much it changed his life, he tries to suck as much drama out of it as he can. Mm-hmm. He tries to, like, deflate really tense situations by just, you know, addressing it and getting it out of the way.
Yeah. I should point out, actually, years before I ever saw Annie Hall, I totally did that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
that's pretty cool.
It's sort of like, yeah, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's sort of like I've used one of my favorite lines of Dirty Work in conversations after, that was after seeing Dirty Work, but upon seeing Annie Hall, I was like, I totally did that. And that's cool. But yeah.
Well, good for you. Yeah, we see a bit more relationship and things kind of start getting rocky. The sexual stuff isn't as good. He's worried that she always has to smoke marijuana to make sex enjoyable, mm-hmm. or else he's really distant. And again,
when he pulls out that red light bulb, obviously she's going to want to get high.
Yeah. Should have been a strobe light. I guess that's just asking
I don't think those are on the home market yet.
That's true. They're still in testing phase. Yeah. And then, again, kind of going back, it bounces back kind of between good things and bad things for their whole relationship. And then things are going well, and they decide to have dinner with her family in their home in Wisconsin.
Yep.
And we get to see kind of where Annie comes from and mm-hmm. a little bit of why the way she is. Mm-hmm.
Which we saw with Alvy earlier in the movie.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's an interesting scene. Her Grammy Hall does not care for Alvy's Jewishness, I think, is what we learned.
Yes. That's the big... Other than Christopher Walken being awesome in 1977, that's the big thing we learn in that scene.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think Deer Hunter was right around this time, too. So
true.
People were wising up.
A different kind of awesome, though.
Yes. Well, they're both crazy. Both characters are crazy.
But one played for laughs and one absolutely not at all. I'll just take this chance to mention Jeff Goldblum's appearance in this movie as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love that scene that he's in, so I feel like we'll talk about that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And also just Sigourney Weaver is also in this one.
Did really? You catch it?
She is at the end when Alvy and some other girl meet up with Annie and some other guy at the movie, like right at the end.
Oh, yeah.
That's Sigourney Weaver. She just doesn't say anything.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I know.
This is like a year before Alien, too.
Yeah. I just want to mention these, like, Christopher Walken, very small part. Jeff Goldblum, literally one line. Sigourney Weaver, no lines. Yeah. So just thought I'd point that out.
Yeah, yeah. I never knew Sigourney Weaver was in this.
Yeah, and then some more kind of, I don't know, postmodern fourth wall breaking. You kind of just ask people on the street for relationship advice and they talk a bit. Another one of the really weird scenes in this one is the Snow White clip. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
Where they actually kind of go into the Snow White movie and Woody Allen becomes animated for a little bit.
Yep.
And, you know, just really, it's a different movie in a lot of ways. And it seems like that, the balcony scene where they like they have their subtitles for what they're actually thinking and stuff. Mm-hmm. Just Woody Allen and Marshall Brickman, the other one.
Yep.
You can see they're just kind of doing things different and really trying to have fun with, you know, the idea.
An extremely postmodern movie. And I remember it was just over a year ago, I took a friend of mine who likes good movies, who had never seen Annie Hall, and we went to see it. And she was very surprised by how modern the movie was.
Yeah.
She thought it was just going to be another one of those movies that I'm sort of just freaking out over, you know, like, you haven't seen The Graduate? What's wrong with you? Although The Graduate's a great movie. Anyway. I remember her being very impressed by how modern it all felt. And she's totally right in that.
Yeah.
I don't know. This movie has had such a big effect on pretty much any sort of good relationship movie that's come since.
Yeah. And I think we'll talk about that a bit too. But yeah, it definitely was very, I mean, it seems experimental, but it all works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, modern. You can be experimental and
fail.
it's easy to fail, but when it works, it works, and it works really well, particularly in this movie.
Yeah, for sure. And so they break up again. We see them break up again. Albie dates that skinny girl from Rolling Stone magazine.
Yeah. Played by Shelley Duvall of The Shining.
Yes, absolutely. Mm. And you know, she seems kind of trying to use bigger words than she can handle. And you can see how Alvy's really bothered by this. And you just kind of notice him missing Annie a lot, even though he never says it. Luckily that night, Annie calls at 3 a.m, as you said before, to try to get him to come over to kill some spiders. There are some spiders there, apparently two of them the size of Buick's.
Yep.
But
which, given the size of Annie's apartment, I feel like that's hyperbole.
Yeah, it's true. It's not such a bad idea, $400 a month for an apartment. You can fit 2 Buicks in the bathroom. That's a good idea.
And New York, too.
Yeah, really. But we kind of learned that maybe it wasn't just the spiders that makes Annie call. She kind of breaks down and talks about how much she
misses
them. Good
work, though, with the rhyme. I liked it.
Okay.
Continue. She misses them and they have a weird, awkward kiss on the bed, and it seems like they've gotten back together after this.
Yeah, they say something that is a staple of every good relationship, which is, let's never break up again.
Yes.
Always works, in my experience.
Yeah.
And then they're back together, and she, once again, she goes to sing again. This one works out a lot better, and she even meets Tony Lacy.
The infamous Tony Lacy.
Infamous Tony Lacy, played by fellow first namer.
Paul Simon.
Yeah. He's bad in this movie, right?
Nope.
Really?
Not at all. I think Paul Simon's a good actor.
I find his acting in this to be bad.
I don't at all.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Agree to disagree on that one, because you're not going to change your mind.
That's fine. I'm not going to argue for the merits of Paul Simon. I think he's good.
Okay. And so he offers her a music career, because he's a label executive,
producer,
something.
Seems like he's a producer.
Yeah, makes sense. And you can see that she really likes this idea. Alvy doesn't. And, you know, they're back together, but we're already seeing that their personalities don't line up and things might not be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
This is really illustrated when they do that split screen thing where they're both at their therapists.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
You can hear them both talk back and forth, and they're both saying the same things, but
having different opinions on
exactly.
It,
you know, like, how often do you guys have sex? And he says rarely, ever, only 3 times a week. Yep. And she says it seems like constantly 3 times a week. So again, they're
the facts are the same, but the opinions are not.
Yeah. And so she takes him up. She takes Tony Lacy up on the offer. They go to LA Alvy's friend's name?
Max. It's not actually Max.
No, it's not.
Just call each other Max. I actually forget what his name is, but it's Tony Roberts.
Okay, yeah. So they all go together to LA. She likes it there. He really doesn't. Mm. Then on the plane home, they break up very pleasantly.
Yeah, and I mean, we gotta talk about the party just because I love the party.
Right.
All the brief conversations. You want to talk about Woody Allen making fun of people? Woody Allen hates L.A.
Yeah, and if you thought he hated New York people,
just like, oh, but he gives real good meeting, you know, like stuff like that, and just like the most Hollywood pompousy thing that you could say, and Jeff Goldblum calling his agent to say, oh, I forgot my mantra.
Yeah.
You know, like,
hilarious line.
Yeah.
So good.
All of those lines are hilarious. It's the mantra one sort of overwhelms them all because it's Jeff Goldblum saying
it. And it's so short, but the other one's like, right now it's a concept, but if I get some money, I can make it into an idea and then eventually into a notion or something
like
that.
Which is an amazing line.
Yeah, that's probably completely jumbled.
Because that's how creative idiots talk. And it's just...
It doesn't matter what order those words are.
Someone was talking to me like that recently, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? I was like... Yeah, and they had a better job than I did. I was very upset.
So they, on the plane home, they agree to break out, but then you see them kind of splitting their books and ending things pretty amicably.
Yeah.
But eventually, Alvy realizes he doesn't like new women. He misses Annie, flies back to L.A. to try to win her back. Unsuccessful. And then we kind of close with he's moved on to becoming a playwright, or at least doing his first play.
Mm-hmm.
And then... basically, he has an actor and actress acting out the scene that we just saw of him trying to win Annie back, but...
He changes the ending.
But he changes the ending, yeah. So he really does get Annie back.
Yeah. What do you expect? It was his first play.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I believe is exactly what he says to justify it.
So again, with Woody Allen like playing himself pretty much all the time, do you think that this is kind of him saying, maybe he wouldn't even know it then because he's just getting into drama, but is this kind of what he's been doing for the last... 30, 40 years, like just trying to use these movies to kind of make up for what's going wrong in his life. Because that's what he says. Like, that's why people, you know, do things like this is because life is hard to get right. And with art, you have a bit more control.
Yeah. I don't think that's a Woody Allen specific thing. I think, yeah, he probably is. And
but that's what everyone's doing.
Yeah. And I mean, his most recent movie, Midnight in Paris, was totally about, you know, sort of, I mean, he's kind of aging and it's sort of, he's thinking, well, I wish I could go back to this time. And the idea behind Midnight in Paris was that, well, people from that time still wish they could go back to this time. And yeah, and that's totally, you know, a thing people think, you know, it was an anti-nostalgia movie basically. And yeah, it's similar that way to Annie Hall.
Yeah.
And absolutely, he's writing about himself always.
Yeah, I guess it just with Woody Allen, it's more so the case than maybe like Michael Bay, like, you know, someone who's doing
Michael Bay doesn't write.
Okay, yeah, true. Yeah, okay, I see what you mean.
And I mean, you can sort of you're right. It does depend on things. Like, I mean, the Coen brothers don't always write about themselves, but A Simple Man was totally about the Coen brothers.
Yes, for sure.
You know, some people do it all the time. Some people never do it. Like before Inception, I don't think Christopher Nolan was ever writing about himself in movies that he wrote. But, you know, some people do and some people don't.
Yeah.
But it's always sort of – art is always sort of a way to either reflect your life or show a version of life that you'll never have.
Yeah, you know? Try to fix it. Yeah, for sure. And I guess it's just funny because he's doing this – like he's writing this play to fix a relationship within this movie that he – co-wrote
or sorry or I should say that I just realized that I totally eliminated so many movies from what I did by what I just said. It's not always about your life or a version of life you wish could happen, or, you know, like a version of life you'll never live. Very often it's about sort of like an issue and, you know, things like that.
Yeah,
like, there's
but I mean
I was
personal
totally wrong
movies
there. Yeah, personal movies, that's
yeah
right.
And that's what I think I was trying to get at, that's what Woody Allen has been doing with so
yes,
many movies
okay.
about himself or almost about himself. And then some of them are just way out there and completely wacky, but mm-hmm. a lot of them are, you know, you can trace back to certain events and certain people in his life.
Yeah, and that, I mean, he gives us a big signifier in that so many of his movies, well, for one, star him, and number two, are clearly him even when they're not starring him. You
yeah.
know? Like, so it's well known that pretty much every lead character in a Woody Allen movie is supposed to be Woody Allen.
Yeah, and that's how they write about it, because I remember when just reading about Midnight in Paris getting cast before any like much had even started on it, they're saying, okay, it's Rachel McAdams and Owen Wilson will be in the Woody Allen role. Like, it's everyone knows it. Yeah. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
So just to kind of wrap up with Annie Hall, they meet again while they're dating other people, as I said, with the Sigourney Weaver thing. Things seem okay. They have lunch together and they talk and things are fine. They don't get back together, but they're friendly. And then we get a montage of the movie we just watched.
Yeah, basically just sort of going back through, it's sort of summing up the memories that he had. Like, it's just quick shots with no audio. Like, I mean, there's a Woody Allen monologue and the song It Had to Be You under it, but you know, it's all just images from the relationship, mostly happy ones, but, you know, some slightly less than happy. And it's just sort of like, well, this is it, you know, like,
yeah.
So
yeah, and there's yeah and then the movie's over. Well received movie. I mean, as you said before, that people he couldn't have possibly expected it to be as successful as it was. Nope. $4 million budget, made $32 million, which is a good amount of money in 1977 for sure. But it was just critically received really well, too.
Yes.
Not absolutely. Just the money that it made. It won Best Picture, Best Actress, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay.
Cool.
At the Oscars. Woody Allen got nominated for Best Actor, but didn't win.
Okay.
Which was
Do you know who did win?
No.
I'm going to look it up. So yeah, he lost to Richard Dreyfuss in Goodnight Girl. Is that what it said?
Yep.
Oh, The Goodbye Girl.
The Goodbye Girl. Classic.
Which has clearly made a big impression on both of us.
Absolutely. So between Best Picture, Best Actress, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay, which of those do you think was deserved?
All of them?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, you're asking me to pick a favorite movie out of a year that was so long ago.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember specifically everything that came out in 1977. I'll just look at the other nominees. I feel like 77 was a good year, though, was it not? Best Picture beat out Star Wars, The Turning Point, Julia, The Goodbye Girl. Yeah, Annie Hall's the best.
Okay. And people say Shakespeare in Love was the last comedy to win Best Picture, but some people are kind of up in the air whether that's a comedy or not. And then before that, the only close one again was...
You can make an argument for post that. I mean, American Beauty can be made an argument for a comedy. Yeah, it's a funny movie.
Yeah, I'd say that's more of a drama, but...
Yeah, no, I think Shakespeare in Love is just as much of a drama as American Beauty, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But what I'm saying is I don't think that is as much of a comedy.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. I disagree.
But, no, with Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, I was trying to... you asked me this question, so I was going through the other nominees to see.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's also the second shortest movie to win Best Picture, because we know now that... The Oscars like the
yes.
2 hour plus
yeah.
drama, epic, big deal movies.
Yep. That's why so many drama movies are 10 minutes longer than they should be, because they're like, oh, we want Oscar consideration. We got to tack on this 10 minutes at the end of The Hurt Locker.
Right. Yeah. So I think it is interesting that it did come out the same year as Star Wars, because they're kind of moving in different directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is such a personal movie, as we've been saying, and... This guy was so involved with every part of it, the writing and the directing and the acting, whereas with Star Wars, it was a very big movie and not very personal. I mean, George Lucas was very involved in it, but it's not so much about relationships. It's about a big battle in space.
Star Wars is personal in a different way, though. Star Wars is taking all of George Lucas's influences and rolling them up into one. So it's very much, it's George Lucas's childhood in a movie. It just happens to be his childhood. He sort of liked to dream of more grandiose things than, you know, just sort of focusing on what was going on around him.
Okay.
Star Wars is a personal movie in a sense. Totally different type of personal than Annie Hall, though. You're correct that way.
Okay. Is there another, I was trying to think of another example of someone who made this transition from someone known just for comedy to someone who all of a sudden got a lot of dramatic chops. Is there anybody who kind of compares to how successful this was as a transition from just a comic figure to a drama figure?
I don't know, because most... Yeah, it's tough. Because there's more of a line now. And I mean, I still classify most of Woody Allen's movies as comedies. I think part of it is that he's been doing it for so long that he's had such a big effect that so many people start out trying to make comedies that are also dramas.
Oh, okay.
That they very often... You know, like Spike Jonze's movies are all funny, but they're also all dramas. Coen brothers, I mean, they lean more towards comedy, but they have such a varied career anyways. I can't think of anybody really off the top of my head. Judd Apatow's trying.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah, that's the closest I can think of is Apatow.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he's trying and so far failing.
Yeah, and another one that I was thinking of that I honestly just couldn't find... a comparison for was how much of an auteur Woody Allen is.
Mm-hmm.
Just because he's writing, directing, usually starring in it. He uses the same music a lot, or at least the same genre of music a lot. He uses the same font for the credits all the time, same black and white for the credits too. And is there anybody who has a movie that are just as instantly recognizable as being from one person, or is there anyone who has made such consistent movies? And I know a lot of people say it's repetitive and he's just making the same movie over and over, but is he too much of an auteur, or is there anybody who can match how kind of distinguishable he is?
I think you're correct in that people that have seen a Woody Allen movie before will know instantly when they are beginning a Woody Allen movie just because of the credits, you know, if only because of that. Yeah. And there are so many things that sort of translate from Woody Allen movie to Woody Allen movie. I think the reason he's not taken more seriously as an auteur is simply because he makes so many goddamn movies. When you make as many movies as Woody Allen does, you're going to make some bad ones. And right. He has. And he will probably, you know, like, let's say he lives another 6 years, he'll probably make more bad movies, you know?
Yeah.
And he's sort of in that phase where when he does make a movie that is kind of good, it's taken as a really good movie. Like, Midnight in Paris got incredible reviews. And I think it's very much sort of the, what was Bob Dylan's, like, 2003 album that got all the Modern Times or something like that. Yeah. It's like that. That's what Midnight in Paris is. And I love Midnight in Paris. I saw it 3 times. I'll watch it again. But it's nowhere near the same league as Annie Hall. And I'm sure most of his movies that people consider bad are nowhere as bad as, you know, bad director's movies.
Yeah.
Simply because they're being compared to these incredible things that Woody Allen has made. And people seem to think that, well, if Woody Allen only made a movie every 2 years, they'd all be classics.
Right.
Which is, I mean, that's sort of deciding for Woody Allen how he should make movies, which is absurd, you know? Yeah. So.
Well, yeah, two things. Like, when you say how often he makes movies, for people that don't know, he literally makes a movie every year.
Very often, too.
Yeah, and has, like, since Annie Hall and before that.
People think Clint Eastwood gets shit done. Woody Allen gets shit done.
It's true. And so
Woody Allen wrote and directed a movie in the time it takes us to record this podcast.
And so what do you think it is about why people... You mentioned that it's because they're comparing it to his other ones. Do you think part of it is that people want to be seen liking Woody Allen when it's even just mediocre because of, you know, kind of the standing that he has in Hollywood with movies like Annie Hall, and kind of people see him as someone who didn't just sell out and, you know, just make whatever movies people want him to make. He's happy making these small, sometimes more artistic movies for not a lot of money.
I don't think people will ever like a Woody Allen movie to be cool, you know? I think,
yeah. Even film critics, though.
Well, I think it's very much, they might like a mediocre Woody Allen movie because they always want Woody Allen to be good, because
right.
they like Woody Allen's best stuff so much that they want it all to be at least good, you know? Like, they want to be able to recommend the new Woody Allen movie because they want people to see more Woody Allen movies.
Right.
So that's sort of it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We were talking about how kind of instantly recognizable his movies are. And, you know, right off the top of the podcast, we were talking about how he kind of has one of those personas that are easily mimicked. Mm-hmm. Is there someone who's as instantly recognizable as him, or an impression is, that is instantly recognizable as a Woody Allen one, other than someone with, like, a really obvious accent or something? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Woody Allen's got a pretty obvious accent, you know?
Like, yeah, he's got the New York one, but, I mean, it's not, like, a big Sean Connery, like, mm-hmm. big European one that's super
That's
noticeable.
True, yeah. I would put Sean Connery ahead of Woody Allen for sure.
Yeah.
I think... I don't know. I feel like to the average person, there's probably a bunch of people, because I don't think the average person knows Woody Allen as well as you do.
Yeah.
You've spent a lot of time watching Woody Allen movies and thinking about Woody Allen movies. And I've done the same, not nearly as much as you.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it for you. I think a Jay Leno impression is more recognizable.
That is a good one, yeah. And way more contemporary.
Yeah.
The other ones I was thinking of were De Niro.
Yes.
A big part of that's the face.
Yes. But I think that a big part of it is the face makes the De Niro impression kind of unique. You know,
like, yeah.
How many impressions rely on the face?
Well, my other example would be Clint Eastwood, mm-hmm. who's a very noticeable American impression, who doesn't have a crazy weird voice or big thick accent, but a Clint Eastwood impression.
Oh, yeah. Those are definitely both more recognizable than
Woody
Allen.
Quickly, yeah. Those are the only two I could think of that were...
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of, I'm sure, like, say, our parents are probably aren't a lot more recognizable than Woody Allen, because they were younger when Woody Allen was a thing that was well-respected in culture. Like, this is pre that thing with the 16-year-old that he's married to, you know, like his
stepdaughter-in-law.
It got a lot harder to take Woody Allen seriously, and we grew up in a time where it is kind of, it's a lot harder to take Woody Allen seriously, and his legacy is going to suffer. And yeah, I agree that a Woody Allen impression is very noticeable to people who know who Woody Allen is, okay. But you have to know who he is.
Yeah. How does Annie Hall fit into, like, 1977, into the time it was created? We talked a little bit about his auteurship. The 70s in film history is kind of seen as New Hollywood.
Yeah, the Hollywood Renaissance.
Yeah, New Hollywood, Hollywood Renaissance, or like the Hollywood Brats. It's kind of got a couple different names. Do you want to just give a little explanation of what New Hollywood is and then maybe how this fits in with it? Like, was this a big part of it? Or
my perception of New Hollywood was sort of the Star Wars and Jaws type of thing. Like, Hollywood Renaissance was Coppola and The Godfather and The Conversation. And
okay, so yeah, maybe you want to talk about
Mike Nichols making The Graduate.
The Renaissance then?
Yeah, I think it's sort of like, you know, the Golden Age leads into the Golden Age of the studio system, you know, and then the French New Wave thing was sort of happening. And then I think generally The Graduate in 1967 is sort of accepted as the beginning of the Hollywood Renaissance, which is where all these American or British or, you know, whatever directors were learning from. Or no, Bonnie and Clyde is sort of recognized as the first one here, that we're learning from the French New Wave. And these directors like Arthur Penn, who did Bonnie and Clyde, Mike Nichols, who did The Graduate, Coppola, who would eventually do The Conversation and The Godfather. Who directed Cool Hand Luke? But, you know, all these directors were sort of able to... they would take these things that were from the French New Wave that were very interesting, like axis breaking and, you know, fourth wall breaking and jump cuts and stuff that seems so simple now, but was, you know, a big deal at the time.
Right.
And would sort of add them into Hollywood movies. And these Hollywood movies got big and they were seen by people. And this is why the 70s and Easy Rider is another big one, Dennis Hopper.
And some Scorsese.
Yeah, Scorsese is a big part of this. And
Mean Streets got really big, and as we've talked about
really,
Taxi Driver.
Really big in a way, yeah.
Yeah, we've talked about Taxi Driver too, how it got seen by a lot of people and was critically acclaimed and kind of ushered in a lot of changes.
Yeah, and Scorsese has sort of kept his image as a part of that Hollywood Renaissance, whereas Steven Spielberg has sort of gone into New Hollywood, George Lucas, and Coppola sort of straddled the line in the 70s and is very much Hollywood Renaissance now when people look back on him. But yeah, and Annie Hall is sort of is a part of the Hollywood Renaissance, I think, in that it is a very postmodern movie. And that was one of the things about the French New Wave that was so interesting. And yeah, I think it's very much more Hollywood Renaissance than New Hollywood. And I think Woody Allen is still more Hollywood Renaissance than New Hollywood because Woody Allen's never really had to bow to commercial things. just because he made such a good movie at such a good time. And all of his movies are generally low budget.
Yeah.
And like he's never wanted to make a big movie.
Yeah.
And
you get a lot of freedom that way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think he said something along those lines that I can do whatever I want if I keep it below this level of money. And that's why he goes, he'll go now to wherever he can make the movie. Cause even as the climate is changing, he's like, okay, so it's not feasible for me to be able to make this movie in New York anymore. I'm going to Spain,
yeah.
You know, like, and yep. He'll go wherever the movie is now. And, I think that's admirable and I think it's cool. And I mean, his movies aren't always as great as, and I mean, he's never made another movie as good as Annie Hall, but he still makes good movies and he still does it on his own terms. And I think that's respectable and admirable.
You know?
I mean, he might be a perv, but, you know, so is Roman Polanski and he made Chinatown.
I was just going to say Roman Polanski.
Carnage looks awesome. I really want to see Carnage.
I haven't even seen that.
It's Jodie Foster, Kate Winslet, Christoph Waltz, and John C. Reilly all in an apartment as parents arguing. Looks really funny.
Sounds like a party. Yeah. You talked a bit about your opinions on this already, but just to get more in depth into it, how well do you think this movie holds up?
Spectacularly.
Very positively, yeah.
I like other movies from this time period more, but my God, nothing holds up better than this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's incredible.
And there are some, you know, dated 70s jokes and pop culture
references. Yeah,
and
of
stuff,
course.
But...
And there are technical things I don't like about this movie. And I mean, I think a lot of times the cinematography is awkward. I love the long takes, but the a lot of the split screen stuff, particularly when the Hall family and the Singer family are sort of in that split screen and talking to each other, is really awkward. And I always forget until like towards the end of that scene that the singers are actually talking to Annie Hall's mom, because it's so, it's not even, it's not focused on at all that Annie Hall's mom is talking.
Right.
And it's just awkward. And those scenes particularly can be kind of awkward, but, you know, in general, this movie is stellar.
Okay.
Know?
Again, kind of looking at it from...
Oh, and another thing, there are more than one time in Annie Hall, you can see characters sort of like get their cue and start walking. Like the scene, scene begins like half a second too early, like the cut. And like there's one in Tony Lacey's house. There's one where you can see Paul Simon and Woody Allen start walking. Like they're clearly standing and now they start walking. And there's one in Annie's apartment when they're having an argument. You can just see Woody Allen just be like, "Now I start walking." It's just like, it's a half second thing, but it's just such a big deal. You know?
Yeah. But, yeah. From the technical side, for sure. Looking at it back now, I mean, we said, how well does it hold up? What's sort of the legacy of Annie Hall? I mean, we know it's well respected, but what do you think, how did it change things now? How is the kind of the movie climate different because of a movie like Annie Hall getting made? What kind of movies do you think we wouldn't see without Annie Hall being
500 Days of Summer?
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Everything that's good about Annie Hall, or 500 Days of Summer, came out of Annie Hall. Like all the experimental stuff they do in 500 Days of Summer, the fact that it is a good relationship movie, told in the postmodern style, is Annie Hall. I mean, it's outside of saying it wants to be Annie Hall, that movie wants to be Annie Hall. You know?
Okay.
So, and I mean, it's a decent movie sometimes. So,
sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wrote about it a couple of weeks ago. I go back and forth on it, but I said it's Annie Hall for people born after the release of Annie Hall, and I think that's totally true. Okay. And I think you will, you'll get movies like this every once in a while, just sort of relationship movies that are sort of postmodern and not necessarily the typical rom-com type of thing. But I would like to say, I think as far as storytelling, I think Annie Hall has had a lot of influence. Like, it's got to be things that we just don't think of, like any sort of postmodern storytelling.
Yeah.
That it was accepted on such a wide level in Annie Hall makes it sort of easier to pitch, right?
Yeah.
It's like, well, we're doing this and it's kind of like Annie Hall. I mean, I don't have specific examples, but it had to have been part of that, you know? Because it is... there is a lot of time shifting in this movie. And I mean, I was talking about the Hollywood Renaissance, and time shifting was something that was used in the Hollywood Renaissance. Like, I mean, The Godfather 2 was told in two different timelines.
Yeah.
But
and people loved it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so that's a part of it too. But I think Annie Hall, the way it sort of jumps around, and there's never a clear time as to when this is happening. And I think that had to have had a big influence, even though I can't point to anything specific.
And
but like all those Charlie Kaufman movies that go everywhere, you know, like,
yeah.
And I can't imagine Charlie Kaufman doesn't like Woody Allen movies, you know?
Yeah. That's a pretty, pretty safe assumption. Yeah. I would think, you mentioned Judd Apatow. Do you think he owes a lot to, Larry David?
Nice.
Next question. Woody Allen being as popular, like Annie Hall and Woody Allen being as successful as they are. Cause it's just sort of and I know people were doing this before Woody Allen made Annie Hall, but kind of just mixing the rom-com, like it's a romantic comedy, but with some good drama, but not afraid to maybe make some like cheaper jokes, but still be serious a lot of the time.
Yeah, I think, I mean, as far as comedy, yes. Judd Apatow has been influenced by Woody Allen. As far as thematically, I think Judd Apatow's movies, and we talked about this before, are more John Hughes,
right.
Because his movies are about growing up as opposed to himself. I mean, it's about himself growing up, but Woody Allen sort of is looking at different aspects of life, but always how they relate to Woody Allen.
Yeah.
And I guess you could say the same, but I think the majority of Judd Apatow's movies apply to more people than the Woody Allen's movies.
Yeah.
I think Annie Hall is a universal movie. Not so much with every other Woody Allen movie specifically.
Yeah, and Annie Hall, I mean, you do see him as a little kid at the start. You do see him when he's younger, and he does talk about his family. But I do think that, Judd Apatow and movies like Knocked Up and stuff, it is about that, you know, the things that happen in that transition, that growing up, not just like, okay, here I am now. This is how things function for me now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You said Larry David. Did you have something about Larry David?
A little bit. Just if he owes a lot to Woody Allen.
I don't know. Like, I don't know enough about... the Larry David aesthetic. Like, all I know is Seinfeld.
You know,
I don't watch Curb. I never saw Whatever Works. So, I mean, I asked that question to you.
Yeah, I guess. And I mean, again, it's not as though Woody Allen was the first one to do it, but it's kind of just that, you know, a creative person, well, I mean, Larry David or Woody Allen, playing a variation of themselves, sometimes by the exact same name, dealing with a lot of things from their past. You know, in Annie Hall, he talks about his divorces and his new ones, and then in Curb,
his new relationships.
His new ones, yeah. In Curb, you know, he was single for a bit, and then, yeah, he's married at the start of it, and then they have a divorce, and then try to get back together, and it really is just kind of reflecting what's happening in Larry David's life. He's, you know, another Jewish New York liberal.
Who hates everything.
Who hates everything, and, you know...
Larry David's a little bit more upfront about it.
And, yeah.
And just pure rage.
Yeah. But I mean, pretty self-deprecating, germaphobe, you know, a lot of these things like that. Having a hard time really connecting with other people and breaking down social norms and stuff like that. I just see a lot of comparisons there.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, I know both of their work less than you do. Yeah. But just from an outsider's perspective, absolutely. I think you're correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the other thing I wanted to say was sort of like how Annie Hall caught on. Like we talked about how, there's no way Woody Allen expected this movie to be as good as it was. Yeah. And I think part of it, I mean, I touched on it a little bit, is that it's sort of just a memoir. And we mentioned earlier that, Diane Keaton and Woody Allen had a relationship. Woody Allen has denied that this movie is autobiographical, whether or not that's true, regardless. Before I knew they had a relationship, I saw this movie as a memoir. And I think the reason the movie connected with so many people is watching it is kind of like thinking back to your own relationship and or a relationship of your own. And, you know, like I said earlier, you don't think of everything in order. You're not always rational about the way you're thinking about these things. Like when Woody Allen goes to LA towards the end, he's like, I'm coming there and I'm bringing you home.
Yeah.
And you're not always being rational, but you're just, it's just something that you like. And I mean, when you see them again, you're happy, like towards the end of the movie, when they go to lunch, you know, back in New York, and you know, he sees her coming out of the sorrow and the pity, and he takes it as a personal triumph.
I like that part.
Yeah, it's funny. And because that's sort of how people will like to see people they used to date, because it's sort of like, well, this person had a huge effect on me. I still think about them all the time. I like to see her coming out of something that I introduced her to, because that means I had an effect on her. It's comforting. It's like, well, I've put all this thought into this person. This person's putting this thought into me, even though we're not together. And there's just sort of like the very ending of the movie. And I love the very beginning and the very ending of this movie with the jokes, the Groucho Marx joke, basically about, I wouldn't want to be a part of a club that
would have me as a member.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also the part about, I hate this restaurant, but such small portions, you know, like those are great. And, but the ending one about, do you remember the ending joke?
Yeah. It's, this guy's at his therapist and he said, Doc, my brother thinks he's the chicken. And the doctor says, well, why don't you turn him in? And he says, well, I'd love to, but I need the eggs.
Yeah. And then the movie ends with, Alvy saying, well, that's kind of how I feel about relationships. You know, they're crazy, they're irrational, but so many of us need the eggs. The movie connected with so many people precisely because so many people need the eggs.
Yeah.
And since so many people need the eggs, you know, so many people love the movie. And because it sort of reflected, you know, we're all sort of looking for an Annie Hall, somebody that understands us. Whereas Annie Hall, the movie, is a movie that understands how we're all looking for somebody like Annie Hall.
Yeah.
And we all need the eggs. And, you know, Annie Hall is sort of... Annie Hall, the person, is in the movie, is sort of something we're all kind of looking for or want to have. And looking back on our personal Annie Hall is like watching a version of Annie Hall that we wrote. And I think that's why it's connected with so many people. That's why it continues to be spectacular, because anybody that has had a relationship that with somebody that they still want to do well, you know, it didn't end in just pure hatred.
Yeah.
You know, like it can always be relatable to Annie Hall. And it was just such a relatable movie that, yeah, I just think it's spectacular. It will not get any worse in my lifetime.
Yeah. Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
So would you say it's almost as good as Garden State? Because that's also about dating a kooky girl. And
yeah. There's a difference.
Yes, there is.
So thank you for listening to our podcast about Annie Hall. Check back next week where we'll be talking about David Fincher.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Darth Vader. I'll be honest, the mask doesn't make me brave like that. I just think it sounds cool. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.